When a child is born into this world, it's a pretty indescribable feeling for the parents, family, neighbors, colleagues, pretty much everyone. It's the beginning of the celebration of a new life. The first time they stand up and take their first steps, birthdays, school days, friendships, relationships, college, graduation, parties, road trips, their first job, their second job, their wedding day. This sounds like I'm describing the life of any regular kid growing up. And every child born in India deserves to live a life that's filled with love in a nurturing home. India has over 440 million children, and not all of them get the chance to live a life like this. 170 million of them face situations of abuse, exploitation, and neglect. And this is caused due to situations like poverty, social exclusion, drug addiction, sexual abuse, crime, or they've been orphaned or abandoned. So what happens to these vulnerable children? What kind of childhood can they look forward to? And as a country, how do we look after them? Welcome to Care of the State, a podcast by Catalyst for Social Action that sheds light on what happens to orphaned and vulnerable children in India. The show helps you understand the system of institutional care, fostering, adoption, aftercare, and how organizations and government institutions work to care and protect these children. Experts from Catalyst for Social Action, or CSA, will be talking to lawyers, researchers, NGOs, and other experts from the space who will help us understand what's happening, what are the struggles, and what can be done to provide a safe environment for these children to grow and reintegrate into society. In this first episode, we're going to talk about the concept of parens patri, which refers to the power of the state to protect children against an abusive or negligent parent or legal guardian and intervene to act as the parent of any child who is in need of protection. This is done through the Juvenile Justice Act, which safeguards a child's rights, regulates organizations that look after them, and helps them reintegrate into society. We spoke to Justice Madan Lokur, a former judge of the Supreme Court of India. He was appointed as the one-man committee to suggest improvements in the working of the homes and organizations under the Juvenile Justice Act 2000 and the Juvenile Justice Rules 2007. He takes us through who these vulnerable children are and what care of the state actually means.
The Juvenile Justice Care and Protection Act, it recognizes two categories of children. Children who are in need of care and protection and children who are in conflict with law. You have children who are in need of care and protection, like free children. You may have missing children. You may have child labor who have been rescued. You have children who have been abandoned. Now you have COVID orphans because of the pandemic. So there are a large category of children who are in need of care and protection. Many of them are kept in children's homes, which are run by the state. And many of them are kept in homes that are run by NGOs, well-meaning persons. So they are taken care of in that sense. All right. What is the quality of care is a different issue, but they have a roof over their head. That much is provided for. So really, the duty of the state is quite vast. The duty of NGOs that run some of these homes is also, quite vast.
The 2011 census data states that there are over 33 million child laborers in India and 84 million children who've been deprived of school education. The 2016 UNICEF report estimates the number of orphans in India are a little over 29 million. And according to the data released in 2018 by the National Crime Records Bureau, there was a 22% rise in child sexual abuse cases compared to 2017. Our host, Satyajit Mazumdar, head of advocacy at CSA, finds out from Justice Lokur which children are considered vulnerable or in need of care and protection.
Can you tell us how are they identified or classified as children in need of care and protection, and what is the process around that?
Classification or categorization is not possible in that sense. But you have children who are victims of circumstances. COVID orphans, for example, before the COVID came, there were no COVID orphans. They were not classified or categorized as COVID orphans because there was no COVID. So circumstances change. So you could have children who are victims of domestic violence in the sense that the father has remarried or the mother has remarried. Maybe the child is abandoned by the parents. You could have children who are lost. You have missing children. They get abducted or kidnapped or something, forced into child labor, or maybe forced into trafficking. But these children, when they are identified in that sense, they are produced before the Child Welfare Committee. And then the Child Welfare Committee takes over the responsibility of the care and protection of the child. So the Child Welfare Committee has several options. One of them is institutional care, that is sending the child to an institution so that the child can be looked after. Then depending upon the circumstances, you could have at some stage adoption of foster parents. So there are some options that are available to the Child Welfare Committees. But by and large, what is being done by most of the Child Welfare Committees, if not all of them, is to send the children into institutional care. But I think the time has come to look at other options as well. One of the reasons why I think we should look at other options is because of the quality of care that is provided by many of these institutions.
In 1992, India ratified the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is a legally binding international agreement setting out the civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights of every child, regardless of their race, religion, or abilities. It was adopted by the UN in 1989. The UNCRC consists of 54 articles that set out children's rights and how governments should work together to make them available to all children.
India ratified the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child in 1992. Since then, what are the few significant changes that have taken place in the Indian child protection system?
The biggest change, or the most significant change, is that there is an awareness of child rights. Well before the CRC, in 1986, we had the Juvenile Justice Act. It was not being implemented. Then we had another Juvenile Justice Act in 2000. That was also not being implemented, even though we had ratified the CRC much earlier. Really, I think this movement for recognition of the rights of children began sometime maybe in 2006 or thereabouts, 5, 6, 7. Thereabouts. Now, once people are aware of the fact that children have rights, ancillary problems that exist, which are associated with the rights of children, have come into focus. For example, child labor. All right, issues of child labor were always there, but there was no focus on it. Then people began taking issues of child labor very seriously. And as you know, Mr. Kailash Satyarthi got the Nobel Prize for the work that he had done with child labor. But then you have other rights which are also there. For example, child marriages. You know, should children get married at a very young age, at the age of, say, 10, 12? What about issues of trafficking? Okay, that is something that was not being talked about to a very large extent. I remember that there was an occasion when some girls were picked up from a brothel in Delhi, minor girls, and they were accused of an offense without the police or the courts realizing that they were actually victims of trafficking. Okay, so that change in the mindset came around this time. Recognition that there can be sexual offenses committed against children. That was something that was never discussed or talked about. But yes, we have now the POCSO, the Act, which talks about sexual offenses against children. These are some aspects of law. But then you have something positive. For example, the right to education. That's also a right that children have. The right to adequate nutrition. You have the right to health care. So these are some positive rights which also became important. And the focus shifted into appreciating that children also have rights and they must also be looked after.
The UNCRC also emphasizes that the state is mainly accountable for protecting children's rights and that it should set up a holistic child protection system. Ms. Arlene Manoharan is the head of restorative practices at Enfold India, an organization addressing gender-based violence and child sexual abuse. She explains the various mechanisms and systems that exist to protect and care for children in need.
Firstly, there are a range of laws, almost about maybe 16 to 18 different kinds of laws enacted. And these laws provide entitlements for children. So rights that can be claimed by children because they can be justiciable, one can go to a court to access these rights or to demand these rights. There is a vast and robust body of law that provides for this. We also have something called the Child Helpline, which I think is being a huge resource for many children who are impacted by violence, by crime, and who just have to call 1098 to get access to help across India. So this is a useful tool. I only hope that this child line is also established within childcare institutions. A phone is also established within police stations where children may be at harm by the duty bearers themselves. So this is another mechanism or a service that can be made more accessible for children for their care and protection. Under the Juvenile Justice Act in particular, this act is an umbrella legislation which is really bringing together a number of authorities, bodies, and services. And under this act, there's something called the Child Welfare Committee. Now, this is a body that consists of five individuals, a chairperson and four other individuals, one of whom has to be a woman. And this is a multidisciplinary body where a teacher, a doctor, a social worker, a counselor, persons with relevant experience for a minimum of 7 years, and now with the Amendment Act, even psychiatrists and others. This body of five members is vested with the power of a judicial magistrate of the first class in order to conduct inquiries related to children who may be a child in need of care and protection. The Child Welfare Committee can then pass an order, it's a legally binding order, to place this child in a setting which could be an institutional setting or a non-institutional setting for care and protection. Or the committee could also restore this child back to a family along with support that the family may need through family strengthening. And this could include a sponsorship that could be granted, wherein the state is required to then pay a small amount every month to the family to support the needs of the child in terms of education, medical needs, or other needs of the child. Other kinds of services that could be provided to the child is in terms of a placement in foster care. So suppose temporarily or for a longer period, the family is not a suitable place for the child could be placed in a family that has been authorized as fit to provide or to foster this child. So it's a family-like environment. It's not the child's own family, but it's a foster family. And here the extended family members, the say grandparents or aunts and uncles, extended the kin and kith of this child could also be identified as foster carers for this child. In terms of a fit person, somebody who is found fit by the Child Welfare Committee could also be authorized to provide care and protection to this child. Some children who can also be declared as legally free and fit for adoption. In these situations, the child is declared that the child does not have parents Perhaps this child has been surrendered by the child's mother for, you know, unavoidable reasons beyond her control, is unable to take care of this child. The committee then decides, conducts a thorough inquiry through various procedures, and declares this child is free for adoption. If this child is leaving this child care institution and has attained the age of 18 years, this child is entitled to another kind of support, and this is called aftercare, for another 3 years, and in exceptional situations for 2 more years. And here the child is given some financial support, some training, some placement services, so that you enable these children to integrate into the community with dignity, with independent living skills. You also have other bodies and various kinds of commissions, including the National and State Commission for Protection of Child Rights, the Human Rights Commissions at the national and state level, the National and State Commissions for Scheduled Caste Children, for Scheduled Tribe Children, the Commission for Women, which also responds to the needs of girls. So these various commissions are required to also look into the human rights violations of children and to hold the state accountable, to be a watchdog of the state, to conduct public hearings, to listen to the voices of children and youth and families about the grievances that they have about access to justice, access to their rights. Under the Legal Services Authorities Act, you have free legal aid that is provided for children and families under that act. So if you look at a systems-based approach, we are required to work together in a convergent manner and strengthen the protective nature of the environment around children, strengthen children themselves in order to enable them to claim their right to protection, and address child protection issues in a comprehensive and integrated manner when they do arise.
A report by the National Human Rights Commission states that the 7th Five-Year Plan of India led to the structured expansion of child development services. In order to give it focused attention and direction, a separate Department of Women and Child Development was set up for the first time in the Ministry of Human Resource Development in September 1985. So from the 7th Five-Year Plan onwards, the judiciary and the Supreme Court also played an active role in upholding the rights of a child. Satyajit gets an understanding from Justice Lokur about some of the challenges the judiciary and the state faced when trying to uphold a child's rights.
One of the major problems is a lack of sensitivity or an apathy towards the problems that children face. I think that the awareness campaign and the rights campaign has, to a very large extent, woken up civil society and woken up the state authorities. But there is still this lack of sensitivity. The police, for example, are not adequately trained. So you may have an SJPU in some district, but it's probably there only on paper. Has the person been trained? Have other police officers been trained to deal with problems of children? As far as the judiciary is concerned, there are problems of large number of cases pending before the juvenile justice boards. Many of the states have still not appreciated, many of the high courts have also not appreciated, that in every district you need a juvenile justice board. The law mandates that. And it's not as if the Juvenile Justice Board, you know, can sit only once a week or once a fortnight. They have to sit on a regular basis and do their job, because the whole philosophy behind the Juvenile Justice Act is that of reintegration, restoration, and rehabilitation. So if you have a child who has committed an offense, the idea is to find out why has the child committed that offense. Okay, that's the first step. Can the child be brought back into society? Is it because of some social problem? Is it because of getting beaten up at home? Can something be done to help the child get back into society? Supposing a child has committed a crime and has been given a sentence, can that child be reintegrated into society, or will that child carry that stigma for the rest of his or her life and be a nuisance to society? Children who are accused of offenses need legal representation. the judiciary has not stepped forward in a big way in providing legal representation to children. The state has not provided counseling to children, all right? Support persons, counselors, these are essential for the state. NGOs, they are doing a good job, but they must also get actively involved and ensure that the authorities under the law and the governments wake up. They should be in touch with the juvenile justice committees of the High Court and bring to their notice what is the problem. The Juvenile Justice Committee of the High Court has great moral authority. And if the problems are brought to the notice of the committee and by the NGOs or by, you know, public-spirited persons, I'm sure a change can be brought about. I think the judiciary also needs to look at, and of course the government and society, also needs to look at diversion. It's not as if every case has to come to the Juvenile Justice Board. Many of them need not even come to the court. But then for that, you need counselors. You know, you need persons who can advise the children, who can advise the parents, who can take steps, you know, for rehabilitation and reintegration. So there are quite a few problems, but I don't think any one of these problems is insurmountable.
Arlene at Enfold Proactive Health Trust has been working with child survivors of sexual abuse and other vulnerable children who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. During COVID, Enfold took sessions on personal safety, sexuality, internet safety, and POSH, which stands for the Prevention of Sexual Harassment at the Workplace. Arlene gives us examples of some innovative and successful initiatives which she has been a part of.
I would feel a little bit more happy to talk about one initiative that Enfold has done because I've been associated with it, and this is something called Nanu Samartha. In Kannada, it means I am capable. This particular initiative was also undertaken or devised based on our recognition of the needs of children who were being released from these childcare institutions during the pandemic and had really nobody to connect with, no safe person who they could call when they needed help. We identified some of these children, children in conflict with law, released from observation homes, children who've been released from children's homes because they turned 18, going back to the community. We devised an online program wherein we were able to bring these children together in something called life skills capacity building on skills that they would need to navigate the challenges that they were going through. We provided them with smartphones, helped them to understand the use of Zoom, sent them data, checked in with them how they were doing, and facilitated these sessions on various topics: self-awareness, financial literacy, understanding and managing their own emotions, particularly during the pandemic, their levels of anger and frustration. What would it mean to envision their life of their future? What do they need to make good decisions and solve problems? Creative and critical thinking, gender sensitivity, reproductive health, women's rights.
What needs to be done to ensure that more children can be brought into the safety net and we are able to reach out to all children and families who are in need of support?
I would like to really highlight first that there should be no cuts in budgets for children. The budget for children in 2021 in the union budget was only 3.16%. So I would talk about the need for budget to not be lowered and existing budgets perhaps to be enhanced. Social protection schemes. First of all, the children who are in a situation of risk, the district level needs assessments needs to be done to identify children at risk. And to also identify resource mapping, both resources of the government as well as civil society and the corporates. Who are the individuals, organizations, companies that are willing to step forward? And I'm really happy with corporate social responsibility. And then when we do a gap analysis and we bring this to the notice of the district child protection unit and the district magistrate, who has been given more role under the JJ Amendment Act of 2020-21. This district magistrate already plays, so many roles in terms of ensuring these laws and schemes are being implemented. we need to strengthen this district magistrate. We need to strengthen this district child protection unit because these are the nodal units and bodies at the district level, at the village level, at the rural areas. The village level child protection committees, block level child protection committees, these need to be supported to be made more functional so they can recognize children at risk. They can have databases that are constantly being updated. And this data has to be used in a manner that is really responding to these needs. I do believe that there are many, many more children who are outside the child protection, the juvenile justice system, than who are inside. Once these children are referred to the services in the child protection system, I believe that it is even more important to ensure that these needs and rights of these children are met through individualized, child-centered interventions, the individual care plans that the JJ Act talks about. How much focus and attention is given to training and accountability for the preparation and implementation of these individual care plans? They're meant to be individualized. They're meant to be focused on care and protection. And the child needs to have a voice. Child's family needs to be supported. Unless the child who enters a safety net, enters the child protection system, receives the services and support that the child requires and doesn't fall out of this net, there'll be more and more children and families who are disillusioned. There will be more duty bearer staff and counselors and social workers who are also being disillusioned. And this revolving door of children coming in, falling out, coming in, falling out. This has to stop. We have to generate much more competency building, capacity building. We need to generate more trust and faith in the system and accountability of duty bearers, including ourselves, recognizing that they are rights holders.
Eventually, when the pandemic hit last year, it pushed vulnerable children out of the frying pan and into the fire. In May 2021, taking into account the impact of the second wave of COVID-19, the Ministry of Home Affairs reiterated to states and union territories to focus on vulnerable children who may have been orphaned due to the loss of parents due to COVID-19. Arlene tells Satyajit more about the various kinds of effects that the pandemic has had on them.
How has the pandemic affected children, especially those children whose families are already facing difficulties such as extreme poverty, lack of regular source of income, illness or disability? How has the pandemic affected them?
The Supreme Court had passed a judgment requiring children to be released from these childcare institutions during the pandemic if it is safe for them to do so. The reality is that the vulnerabilities have been exacerbated. If at all, their parents are even in touch with them, because many of these children have been stigmatized, labeled, abandoned by their own families who were anyway struggling in terms of poverty. Those children who have a web going to school, many of them did not have access to this education. They did not have the digital devices. So the digital divide widened this disparity and this inequity. The access to social protection scheme, many of the children that we worked with, their families did not have even a ration card or an Aadhaar card, and the complexities of getting these services through the state services was extremely challenging. We find that particularly girls who were vulnerable in vulnerable situations, some of them were also pushed into working with gangs on the street and getting into situations of crime. And we had not seen these things before. So just like to highlight that the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child had in April 2020 issued a grave warning about this possibility of physical, emotional and psychological effects of the pandemic, and had formulated 11 concrete action points for states, parties to the convention to follow. So government and civil society needs to consider and respond not only to the immediate visible negative impact of the pandemic on children and their rights, but more importantly, we also really need to be aware of and to assess and to prepare for how we can prevent the long-term impact that this pandemic is likely to have very surely on children and their rights.
Satyajit asked Justice Lokur what changes could be made to our current system, which could promise vulnerable children of India a ray of hope and a glimpse into a brighter, better future.
So what are the few changes that you would like to see in our child protection system in order to make our country a safer place for all children?
Well, there are quite a few, but I would just like to confine myself to a couple of them. One is the active involvement of society in issues pertaining to children or issues concerning children. We can't treat children as they're there. They will look after themselves. They will grow up. And then we can start worrying about them. I think society has to start worrying about them from today. Education, for example, they can't start learning, reading and writing and all that at the age of 18 or 20. So I think every member of society must appreciate the fact that the children, that these children are the future of the country. And if we have to make sure that the future of the country is good, we have to make sure that these children grow up in an environment that is conducive to becoming good citizens and responsible citizens of the country. Second, I think, you know, we need greater sensitization about the rights of children. A lot of progress has been made since the CRC was signed. But yes, there are still large pockets where people are not sensitized about the rights of children. There are certain things which should not be done. There are certain things of a positive nature that should be done. The third thing is training at all levels, whether we are talking about the judiciary, whether we are talking about civil society, whether we are talking about the police or the government. The persons who matter should be trained. You can't just have a person getting up one morning and saying that, well, I know everything about child rights just because I'm in the police. I know everything about child rights just because I'm a judge. That's not correct, because you can take wrong decisions. You might mean well, but still your decision might be wrong. So really, I think these are the three key things that we need to look at if we have to move forward.
Every child has a right to protection. This includes those who are in difficult circumstances or have suffered violence, abuse, and exploitation, but also those who are not. While the government, state, and judiciary are working towards caring and protecting children, what can we as a society do? Well, we can be the messengers of hope, initiate a change, and make a difference. In our own individual, collective, personal, or professional capacity, we can invest a little bit of interest in the issues pertaining to a child, educate ourselves about child rights, and find a way to stand up against any violence committed against them. Let's treat every child with dignity. This podcast is our way of spreading the word and to help you understand these issues better. It takes one tiny change in the way we think and the interest we take to help in creating a world that will love, care, and protect and respect the vulnerable children of India. Thanks for tuning in to Care of the State, a series by Catalysts for Social Action. We would love to hear from you. If you have any questions or want to get involved in the work that CSA do, send an email to connect@csa.org.in. Conceptualized and hosted by Satyajit Mazumdar. Marketing and Communications by Hinal Shah, Pranay Jajodia, and Kinjal Mehta. The creative team were Anuja Kokani and Shahaji Patil. This is a Made in India production. Writer and project manager, Veda Sushila Mohan. Production head and editor, Joshua Thomas. Sound mixing by Karthik Kulkarni. Project supervisor, Sean Phantom. And voiceover by May Mariam Thomas.